to Jeff, who is going to introduce Sir Gillian Prance.
Well, good morning. I'm Jerry Barr. I'm the convener of the Greenbelt Ethical and Environmental Unit. Possibly means nothing to you. Well, we're here, and we've been around now for a couple of years because we're greening Greenbelt. And part of that process is inviting some eminent speakers to come and talk about eco-issues. Last year, Jonathan Porritt. This year, Sir Gillian Prance. Now, Sir Gillian was director of Kew Gardens. He has unparalleled experience of the world's biodiversity and its fragility. He's been one of those who's been speaking out about these issues for many years. And sadly, his concerns are, I think, growing. But he'll talk to you about that on his subject, which is The Earth Groans. Sir Gillian.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here and great to see that Greenbelt is becoming greener, because really the environment is one of the most important things we could be considering. Now, I wonder if anyone knows what this is, if you can see from there. Does anyone ever guess what this is? Someone's indicating that it's some sort of sport ball, but it isn't a shot put or something like that. This is actually, if I was to hold up, I hope you can see this. What is that? Yes, he was saying the right thing, someone in the front there, a Brazil nut. Brazil nuts are a funny shape, because they all come in one of these big fruits. And if you thought a Brazil nut was hard to crack, this fruit is hard and woody, and it's even harder to crack. But I want to tell you something about the Brazil nut. It's one of the plants in the Amazon that I've studied in detail. And in order to get this nut, first you need a bee that comes to the flower of the Brazil nut, and is a complicated flower structure, and a bee has to lift a lid to get the nectar, and at the same time it puts pollen from one tree to another. So it's pollinated by this large bee, but the bee is called an orchid bee, and it's called an orchid bee because the males of those bees go to flowers of the orchids up in the top of the rainforest, and they gather the scent from the orchids, and they use that to attract the female bees. So if you didn't have the orchids as well, you would not have the Brazil nuts. Then, after that pollination has taken place, this begins to develop. It takes 14 months from pollination till this large woody fruit. And 14 months later, it falls off the tree, and then there's a little hole in the top of it, and only a large rodent called the agouti can get its teeth into that hole. And it gnaws and gnaws until it enlarges the hole, till it's large enough to get the Brazil nut out of it. And it takes them and buries them in the ground, just like squirrels do with acorns here, forgets where some of them are, and that's what plants the new Brazil nut. So there is an incredible lot of things to get the most important crop from the Amazon rainforest. And many, many plants work like that. There's a web of interactions. I was, after I left Kew, a visiting professor for a year in Hawaii. And there I was taken by the botanist to see a plant on the cliffs, abseiling down the cliff to see the last 14 individuals of a plant called Brighamia, because in Hawaii many of the plants and animals are going extinct. And Brighamia has a long, long tubular flower, and these botanists told me, unfortunately, the moth that has a tongue long enough to get into the nectar in that flower is extinct. so it doesn't get pollinated. And we have to abseil down here with a paintbrush and transfer pollen from one flower to another. So one of the very sad things is we often ask, why does a species matter? Well, these sort of interactions are the wonders of creation, but they're also absolutely vital. If you don't have the pollinator, then you don't get the fruit or the seed. If the Brazil nut pollinator went extinct, then you wouldn't get Brazil nuts. In the case of Brighamia, it has. It's only growing because people are climbing down the cliff and because it's growing in botanic gardens at present. We have no hope for that one without its pollinator, a moth with a very long tongue. In this country, when the bees got a mite, there was a terrible problem in orchards because they weren't getting properly pollinated. So one of my big concerns is the loss of species, whether it is something that pollinates, whether it is the relative of a crop that is very useful for us, or whether it's a species that might be a new medicine. We need to be concerned about species going extinct. And as a Christian, I think, have we any right to send these species of God's creation to extinction? So we, as Christians, need to be concerned about this loss of species. A year ago, I gave two talks, one in the Isle of Wight, one in Canada, under the subject Creation Groans. And I thought when I was asked to speak at Greenbelt, I would look for a different title. But then I thought, well, what has been my experience over the last year, as I've had the privilege of traveling to many places? And I'm afraid to say that creation is still groaning in a bad way. I flew over the Amazon River, over the Amazon region, from the city of Belém at the mouth of the Amazon down to the capital of Brazil, Brasilia. And I was saddened by this flight because the savannas of central Brazil hardly exist anymore. They are all soybean plantations. And because of the world's demand for soy, they're beginning to cut down the southern part of the Amazon rainforest as well to plant soybean. Now, we might think of soy as a good crop, which it is, but it is destroying the Brazilian savannas and the Brazilian rainforest because of the demand that has increased in China, Japan, the United States in particular. Almost all of that soy that's produced in Brazil is exported, either to extract the soy itself or as cattle fodder. So that was one of the sad experiences I had this year. So I was not surprised when Brazil announced their official statistics for 2003, which said that it was the second highest year of deforestation that had ever happened. 23,000 square kilometers of the Amazon rainforest was cut down in 2003, the second highest year ever. So the deforestation hasn't stopped, in spite of all we've been saying for 20 years, in spite of having an environmental activist as the environmental minister of Brazil, and in spite of many Brazilians now pleading for the Amazon rainforest. But the world's demand for soy, the profit that can be made on that, is preventing the environmentalist work to stop deforestation. I visited a place in Ecuador some years ago and saw a ridge where one of the botanists showed me, this is exciting, there's so many unique species here. I have described, he said to me, 100 new species of plant never discovered on the Sentinela Ridge. I went back to Sentinela Ridge when I was in Ecuador in March of this year. There's no forest there at all. It's all farmland. And those species, 100 new species that were known from there, are probably extinct because there's very little of that coastal forest in Ecuador left. So we are causing extinction in many parts of the world. Also, when I was in Ecuador in March, I had the privilege of going to the Galapagos Islands for the fourth time. And at that time, the fishermen there were resisting the legislation that was trying to control them, to control catch, to control season of fishing certain fish, and to stop them over-harvesting the sea cucumber and some of the fish upon which that wonderful wildlife of the Galapagos depends. And like fishermen everywhere, they were resisting this control. It's very like things here at home. News of the week in Science, the Journal of the American Society for the Advancement of Science, this week said that the warden of Fair Isle is very disappointed. The usual cacophony of 250,000 seabirds has been replaced by an airy silence. That's because the kittiwakes, arctic terns, guillemots, razorbills, arctic skuas and great skuas that usually breed on this southernmost Shetland isle have failed to do their job this season. It's the worst year ever here by a long way, said Derek Shaw, the warden. So, in the Galapagos Islands, in the British Islands, there are problems because of overfishing, because that is why the seabirds aren't breeding, particularly because of the amount of sand eels that have been fished out of the sea. And the fishermen are complaining that they're not finding enough sand eels now. Not surprising, because they resist the control of sand eels. So that was another bad experience, seeing the way that the Galapagos fishermen were resisting the necessary control to protect the environment. After that, I went to the Amazon region of Ecuador to visit a tribe of Indians called the Achua. And I had a very nice time learning about the way they use their plants, the sort of study that I do, and I was fascinated by that. But my Achua guide was persistently telling me, you have some influence, and I was with some other people, you're from different countries, go back and tell your countries how we value our territory. And when I got to visit the shaman of that tribe, again, he made an impassioned speech in front of us all about that his tribe, the Achua, that all villages had voted that they did not want the petroleum companies to come into their territory. They know what's happened to the Warani Indians, the Auca Indians, who have been overwhelmed by the petroleum companies in Ecuador. And so I was shown by this Indian a map of the petroleum concessions in Ecuador. And there, on the area where I was, with these wonderful people with a great deal of dignity, was the name ARCO. It was assigned to the ARCO Petroleum Company. So I was not surprised that the Indians had a fear of this. Yet I was there because I was leading a tour of the Friends of the Eden Project. And an Ecuadorian tourist company has set up a tourist lodge amongst the Achua and is training the Achua with the idea of handing this tourist operation over to them completely in 2007 to give them a sustainable way of life which won't destroy their traditional life and won't destroy their forests. So they've got a way of sustaining, a way of interacting with Western society. But the economists of Ecuador want to mine the petroleum that's under their territory. I don't know who will win, but many people are trying to assist the Achua Indians now. But I was very pleased to see their own realization and what they were doing. I visited the United States several times this year too. And as I look around there and see the huge cars, the number of off-road vehicles, four-wheel drive vehicles, and how cheap petrol is, I worry about the consumption of petrol in the world. And yesterday I went to the car park in Lyme Regis where I live and saw all the visitors there, and I think there's a trend towards this in the UK, I'm afraid to say, as I saw lots of these types of vehicles parked by the visitors to the beach in Lyme Regis. So we are contributing to the burning of fossil fuel and the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Then the other interesting thing that I've experienced this year, and sad thing, is freak flooding. I work with a forest reserve in Brazil, and we have constructed a dam to create a wetland below the Atlantic coastal rainforest. This is just near to Rio de Janeiro, and we had built the dam 3 years ago, and it is wonderful how the water birds have come back. And when I was there in December of last year, the huge alligator that I saw there brought great joy to me that just by creating a lake there in this old farm field that was cattle pasture before, nature is coming back to it. But last February, there was about 2 months' rain in 48 hours, a huge flood that they've never had the rain like it in the region, and that washed out part of our dam. It's not that I'm so worried about, we've rebuilt it, but it is the fact that there was this extraordinary rainfall in a very short time. Then in July, I was in Japan, and there was another freak flood in part of Japan while I was there, and great damage and death caused by this flood. And then what happened last week, or 2 weeks ago now, in Boscastle in Cornwall, we had exactly the same, an extraordinary flash flood that did great damage to that village. Why are we seeing so many of these extraordinary weather systems in the world? Well, it's interesting that for several years, the scientists that have been working on climate change have been predicting that one of the indications will be freak storms. It's not just global warming. I don't like that phrase, because climate change doesn't mean that everywhere in the world will get warmer. The average temperature will. Some places colder, some places hotter. But what they do say, in addition to that, is that there will be a lot of freak storms. And we are seeing exactly what they've been saying and began to say about 15 years ago, not just because they're happening, they were prophets, and we don't listen to them. Here is what the European Environmental Agency said in a statement made earlier this week. We're moving towards more intense rainfall. Drier summers are being punctuated by particularly intense incidents, such as we have just seen in Cornwall. The agency said Europe is warming faster than the global average. The temperature has risen by an average of 0.95 degrees centigrade in the past 100 years and is projected to climb a further 2 to 6 degrees this century as emissions of greenhouse gases continue to rise. The concentration of CO2, the main greenhouse gas, is at its highest for at least 420,000 years, possibly even 20 million years. The agency singles out floods in Europe 2 years ago and last summer's heat wave in Western and Southern Europe as examples of how destructive climate change can be. It says wetter conditions in Northern Europe and drier weather in the South could threaten agriculture and completely melt three-quarters of the glaciers in the Swiss Alps. And so it goes on. Climate change is a very, very serious thing. Bangladesh is another country that suffers a lot of flooding and has had another episode of flood this year. And that is combination effect of two things, climate change and deforestation. If you keep the forests in an area, they act like a sponge and release the water gradually to the rivers. If you cut down the forests, then the water has nowhere to go except to run out into the rivers and cause flooding. So we see flooding in Mozambique, the Philippines, Bangladesh, places that have lost their rainforest. So that is serious. As I look at these things, I am reminded of the words of the prophet Jeremiah. How long will the land mourn and the grass of every field wither for the wickedness of those who live in it? The animals and the birds are swept away, and because the people said, he is blind to our ways. Very interesting prophecy there, because it is talking about the animals and the birds being swept away because of the sins of the people. So I'm afraid to say that creation continues to groan, and it is mainly because of the effect of one species on Earth, the human species, Homo sapiens, us. We have a huge responsibility for what is happening. I have to say that in my travels, I see good things too. And I'm not here to be a prophet of gloom, but to think of what we can do instead. I was very pleased in the Galapagos Islands, for example, that there were the same species of birds nesting on the pathways where the tourists walk, the albatrosses clacking their beaks in exactly the same place that I had seen on my first visit there 22 years ago. And so a lot of that ecosystem still going, becoming threatened, yes, because of the removal of some of the food, the fish that are so important, but still a lot of good things there. Just 3 weeks ago, I got back from Brazil, from the Brazilian Botanical Gardens Congress, and the theme of that was sustainability. And the Botanic Gardens of Brazil were really discussing how they can be contributing to a sustainable environment. And my theme that I was assigned was sustainability in botanic gardens. I enjoyed speaking on that, but what I most enjoyed was listening to enthusiastic young directors and staff of botanic gardens discussing this, debating, and talking about what they should be doing with their education programs in schools to show about the environment, what they should be doing to save the endangered species where their gardens are, and this sort of thing. Here was a group that is very active, and has realized that in a country where there is so much environmental damage, the Botanic Gardens have a special mission today. I work with the Eden Project as their scientific director, and I am thrilled when I was there on Wednesday to see the people flocking there to learn about the importance of sustainable living. That's what the Eden Project is about, in order to show the importance of plants to people and to promote the sustainable use of the plant resources of the world. And it is good that so many people are coming to learn about that. I've been carrying out a review for the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, of their program called Plants and People. So I've been learning about the way in which they're influencing wood carvers in Kenya to stop cutting down the last of some of the important timber trees that give their wood and grow fast-growing but still good wood for carving. And so they are beginning to change what woods they use so they don't send some of the species to extinction. And it is working. The Good Wood Project, it's called, and the wood is being certified. At the moment, it's in the process of getting certification. So when you see good wood carvings from Kenya, those are the ones that are environmentally sound. I also see the programs in Nepal and Pakistan, where they're teaching the people who use so many of the plants as medicines that they can't go on harvesting them till the last plant has gone, and so instead training them to cultivate some of the most important medicinal plants. That way, you leave some of them in the field and you have some of them in your cultivated areas. And then another program, the way they have introduced fuel-efficient stoves into Pakistan. And that is helping to reduce the demand for wood, which is destroying the precious remnants of forest that remain in that country. I also visited some years ago a home gardens project in Bangladesh, run by a charity which my wife chaired called Impact, and to see the difference that that has made to the environment and to the people, because the emphasis of those home gardens is nutrition, and to see how by growing some of the plants that produce vitamin A and other essential elements for life, the health of the people is improving. So there is a lot going on. But my question today is, what are you doing? What are we doing here in the UK? Every little bit that we do helps. Are you recycling? I'm pleased that Dorset is one of the best counties for recycling. Every time I go, unfortunately we don't have collection of it, but every time I go, when I'm going somewhere else, of course, to recycle in the car park there, I never go without seeing one or two other people there also recycling. Have you got energy-efficient light bulbs? They do make a very great difference to how much energy you use. I installed about 4 years ago a solar hot water system on my house, and I think that has halved the amount of gas that I use in the boiler. Most of the summer, we don't have the boiler switched on at all because the solar hot water is perfectly sufficient. The improved systems that we have now do work in the UK because they don't need a bright sunny day. They gather up the UV spectrum of light, and so they really function on a day like this perfectly well. Are you composting? That is very important too. Why do we throw away organic waste to go into various garbage? We can keep it out of our garbage. And then you already heard in the introduction here about trade and justice. This afternoon, I'm taking part in a discussion of trade justice. Don't forget to sign the card and vote for trade justice. There is one, I think, in the program that you all got. This is important, and it's important that Christians do something about this, because we, of all people, should be the ones concerned with justice in the world, and we should be concerned with the environment. So I think it's very important that we act in some way. And here at Greenbelt, we've been given a way to act this year, to make a vote. You remember how Jubilee 2000 was something else that the church got involved in. And as a result, a certain amount of debt forgiveness has happened in the world. That is another thing that was a great injustice in the world. And that was really inspired by the church. Perhaps we can also help trade justice in a similar way. But it requires everyone to act, just as so many Christians did in Jubilee 2000. Do you believe that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it? I do. And if you believe that, then I think you have a responsibility to be a steward of it, to take care of the earth. Much good action is happening. There are good environmental laws. There's a lot of rhetoric about the environment. But the situation is getting worse. Climate is getting warming. Species are going extinct. So we are facing a moral and ethical crisis in the world today. And it is so great that it requires people who have a moral and ethical stand to do something about it. It's no good leaving it just to the secular environment. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15 says, "The Lord God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it." The Hebrew words Abad and Shemar used there really mean to serve and preserve the land. The first command to people was to serve and preserve, not to destroy. They were given permission to use it, but not to abuse it. And in Exodus, we read that for 6 years, you shall sow your land and gather its yield. But the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the wild animals may eat. You shall do the same with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. Very interesting that this Sabbath for the land, leaving the land fallow, was not just for the good of land. It is essential for the land, but it is linked here clearly with the poor, so that the poor may eat. But not only with the poor, and what they leave, the wild animals may eat. The Bible is full of ecology. It is full of creation care. And so the challenge to us here at Greenbelt, to all Christians, is that we should be doing something about it. What are you doing personally? One of the things that is helping now and that pleases me, a positive sign, is the few organizations with a firm Christian faith basis that are getting involved in the protection of the environment. One of them, for instance, is the organization called Arrocha. That means the rock in Portuguese, because Arrocha started in Portugal and now operates in 15 countries around the world, but with a clear Christian commitment to help the environment in many different ways in the different countries. If you want to learn more about our Russia, they have a stand in the Pulse. And I recommend that you go to that, because it is an organization that is really doing something about it. Christian Ecology Link publishes this magazine, Green Christians. And again, here is another group of Christians that are concerned about the environment and trying to do something about it. So you'll find Green Christians a useful resource if you want to learn what you can do. They run various campaigns, they produce very good materials, as does our Russia, Ideas for Worship on Creation Sunday. Another organization that puts out very good briefing papers is the John Ray Initiative. That is based nearby here in the University of Gloucester. And again, it is bringing together people to learn about the Christian approach to doing something for the environment. Eco-Congregation is an organization by churches together in Britain and Ireland, and it produced material that really helps churches to present the environment and to become better stewards of the earth. Those are some of the organizations that there are in this country. There are also organizations in the United States that are clearly Christian, because we need not just the secular environment, we need all of you to take part in being stewards of God's creation, because the earth is the Lord's and all that is in it. Thank you. Yes, I am. There's plenty of time for it.
If anyone has any questions, we need to do them from the stage. So if you do have a question, please, if you could make your way very quickly to the stage. The steps are at the side there, on the stage to this mic, and then we'll have a question and answer. So please do come up and ask questions.
My question is, if the solution for the Arca Indians is sustainable tourism, where should the oil that will fly the sustainable tourists come from, if not underneath their feet?
Right, that's a very good question and a dilemma that all of us working in the environment are concerned about. I'm concerned. You've heard the number of places I've been to in the last year flying. And so I am concerned about that very much. I think the answer to that is that we have got to put more money into alternative sources. Is it permanently necessary to travel using fossil fuel? I think not. And I think the ultimate answer must be that, thinking about hydrogen power and other sources of power rather than digging it up. And so there are certain areas that perhaps we can sacrifice the oil. And we need to be more economic with it. If the United States drove cars the size we do in Britain, they would be self-sufficient in oil. And so I don't think there is any need to dig that oil under the Achuar Indian Territory.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk, and it certainly strikes lots of chords with me. I'm a leader in a local church. If I'm trying to put across those kinds of values and approach, could you give any advice, say, the top three priorities that I ought to be putting across?
Well, first of all, if you're a leader in the church, you need to put across why, as a Christian, you should be doing it. So I think that is very important within the church. So you need to get the theology right. So that would be number one. Then what actions should you be doing? Well, first of all, examining the church and seeing what the church itself, what its energy audit comes to, and getting that in order. And then there's so many ways. It's hard to say what would be one priority. But how does everyone come to church? Can you travel together? Can you have a bus that brings you there to save energy? There are various things like that in the life of the church. But I think above all, the biggest crisis today is the energy crisis and what is happening with climate change. And so anything that reduces the use of fossil energy is something that people can do and that the church can promote.
Thank you.
Thank you for an excellent talk, Sir Gillian, and thank you also for promoting the organisations that are working in this area. I work for Christian Ecology Link, one of them. I would like to just exploit your generosity by just plugging one thing that wasn't mentioned, and that is, Sir Gillian mentioned climate change. There is a rainbow pilgrimage to Coventry on the 9th of October, and if people want to show and demonstrate Christian concern for the environment, there's no better way than being seen to be out there expressing our concern for God's creation. If you go to the Pulse, as Gideon said, there are leaflets about this pilgrimage on the 9th of October. Please go there. I didn't come just to give an advert, though. I've got a question. And my question is this. You're far more widely travelled than I am, Sir Gideon. And one of the issues that I find quite complex is the debate between globalisation and localisation. There's a strong trend at the moment, in particularly in food, for example, towards local food, farmers' markets and so forth. Many of us sort of wrestle with some of the issues that if we're buying tradecraft food, for example, it often has been flown or shipped a long distance away. Where do you stand on this debate between globalisation and localisation in terms of our buying behaviour?
That's a very important question and something that we must address. I think that there are many products that it is absurd to fly across the world that we can grow in the UK, and we ought to be fostering farmers' markets, local markets. I always look for the local cheeses in shopping, go to the farmers' market. But it is encouraging to see the increase in organic food, but even more important is the mileage that that food has travelled. We want to be concerned about food mileage. On the other hand, there are some products that we can't grow in the UK. We can't get bananas to grow here in any quantity, or coffee or chocolate. And there we have an opportunity to help people in the developing world by using fair trade. It's very important that we're selective in that way. And so I think it depends on the product, really. And I would just add also that I'm sorry I didn't mention the march in Coventry. That is another way, demonstrating like that we can. And that's another activity of Christian Ecology Link. So I think that we definitely need to see which products it is, which way we go.
Hello, thank you for your talk. You mentioned the importance of conserving fossil fuel and not driving large cars, but you also mentioned there's a lot of air travel that you did in the last year. And I was just wondering what you thought about the fact that most airlines are subsidized by their governments, whereas petrol is actually taxed. And how do Christians decide whether they're going to go on a long-haul flight or stay local?
I think one of the important things that we should be doing is trying to persuade the politicians that air fuel should be taxed. We are travelling far too cheaply. And the more discount we see, the discount flights are because They don't pay tax on air fuel. And I think that would make a difference and make us more selective in when and where we travel and looking for other options, particularly on short flights. It's not necessary to fly around the UK generally. We're in too much of a hurry. So I would advocate that we try and get air fuel to be taxed.
Hi. In a way, I was a bit disappointed that you mentioned the issue of sand eels in Shetland, because I think the issue of sand eels is more complex than just overfishing. But in a community which is totally dependent, or very dependent, on fishing, and admittedly the big multi-million pound boats that hoover up the seabed have done an awful lot of damage, but decommissioning and things is actually getting the small fishermen out of business. And those folk are now unemployed, and anything that you do on that scale then has an impact on the community. And in fact, so it attacks and begins to destabilise the whole community, which has lost a couple of thousand people in a population of 23,000 in the last 10 years. So what are your answers for a community like that?
Well, we have to try and find alternative to employment in a community like that and others. I've seen that with the local fishermen in Cornwall and in the south of England where I live. So it's not by no means a problem confined to the Shetlands. The sand eels are largely gobbled up by large fishing concerns from Denmark, and they're doing the damage. I feel that those seabirds have a right, and that it is tragic that they have not been breeding this year. And this is not confined to the Shetlands. I just gave that example because it happened to be in this week's Science. It's a general trend that there's not enough food for them, so there's something wrong. It's important to act on that. But we do, of course, have to consider what can we do for the people that are unemployed by that, and redeploy them into other things. Perhaps one of the things that we can do is begin to grow more food locally and link it with the last one. Certainly that is an option in the south, maybe not for Shetland. I don't know the local circumstances as what you could do there, but I'm sure someone with vision can find something for those fishermen to do.
It's a very complex problem in an area like Shetland where you can't just turn to other...
It is a complex problem, but the life of those seabirds is important too. They're part of God's creation.
Thank you for a fascinating talk, Sir Gillian. I am an aid worker, and I work with refugees. And one of the problems we have is that refugees require large amounts of food, and they also eat wildlife and they cut down trees. And one of the problems that the aid community is coming up with at the moment, one of the solutions that the aid community is coming up with at the moment is the use of mapping so that we can track where people are, how many of them there are, what condition they're in. I just wondered, when you were talking about 23,000 square kilometres of rainforest being cut down, I mean, that number is just mind-boggling, and I can't visualise it. Do you know of any organisations in your sector that are actively mapping so that little ants like us can actually see the scale of the problem?
Yes, that is. The rainforest deforestation is being mapped by the Brazilian space agency called INPE, and they publish maps and data. If you look at INPE website, you can pick up the maps that show the deforestation. Another organization that is doing mapping and producing some of the data that is much more user-friendly is Conservation International, an organization based in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Okay. Last question. First of all, if you haven't been to the Eden Project, please do go. It is absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
My question really is that I come from a comfortable Christian community. Comfortable in the south of England, and everybody has their own home pretty well and is comfortable. But there is a a planning request has gone in to build wind turbines up nearby us, and there's a huge reaction against that. What should my approach be to those people?
Your approach should definitely be to encourage the wind energy, because this is... Thank you. I'm glad to see that so many of you appreciate that, because this is a wonderful source, God-given source of power for us that doesn't do anything to the environment in that way. And as I drive in various places and see those windmills turning, it gladdens my heart. It doesn't make me feel... that they're ugly on the eyesight. For instance, as I drive down into Cornwall and see those nice turbines there, I think of what they are doing. The only caution I would say is we should not put them on the main routes of migratory birds. And that is the one caveat I would give. But wherever that is not so, let's build as many as we can and produce energy by wind, by tide, by any way that doesn't create more carbon dioxide in the air.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Sir Gillian Prance.